G'day, Groovers. Welcome to another instalment of You Know What with You Know Who and Thingo over there at What's His Name. G'day, Thingo.
Hi.
Are you all right?
That's so informative. That's fantastic.
I know, and so disrespectful. And all our new listeners are going, what the fuck is this? Melissa Cameron, of course, is the producer of my show, the boss of me, the manager of my life. And she seems like Mary Poppins on air, but off air, she's a fucking tyrant. Don't let that persona fool you. Welcome to the You Project, of course, everybody. I am Craig Harper. We're not sure what episode this is, so I'm not going to tell your number. I'm going to tell you it's 301 or 302, but we're recording this Thursday. Is it Thursday?
It is Thursday afternoon.
Have you had a good day today?
I have had a great day, thank you. I think the sunshining is helping as well. How about you?
All right. I wish they made PhDs easier. That would make my life easy. But no, it's I actually don't think the process is the problem. I think I am the problem. But it's been good. Yesterday I had a bit of an average day. I felt like punching myself in the face. But we did interview Dinesh, who's up today, which today being Thursday. After I spoke to Dinesh, who, if you haven't listened to that podcast, please do. He's a quadriplegic, which is not the important thing, but the important thing is he's an unbelievable human who's a doctor, who's a lawyer, who's an Order of Australia medal winner, who's an advocate for a bunch of different causes, who's a TEDx speaker, who's just a phenomenal human and happens to live life in a wheelchair with a spinal cord injury. So after I spoke to him, Melissa, I felt like you better not feel sorry for yourself, Craig Harper, and you better get the fuck up and have a crack, because you don't have any problems whatsoever. So that was me. Did you love him?
Ah, I loved that. I loved him. I loved that episode, just learning about him. Mm. It was fantastic.
Now, Michelle Gibbings, we're about to introduce you. So no pressure, no pressure at all, Michelle, but you do have like a fairly high bar that you need to try and jump up to. Michelle's just released. She's done a bunch of stuff and she'll tell us about that. She's got a new book out called Bad Boss, What to Do If You Work for One. Melissa, perhaps we shouldn't have you on this episode. I'm just thinking as I'm saying this. Bad Boss, What to Do If You Work for One, Manage One or R1. Manage One? Manage One or R1. Wiley, that's being published by Wiley. $27.95 and all good bookstores and a few shit ones. Hi, Michelle.
Hello. I was about to say, I'm sure Melissa has this whole damn pat, because if she works for one, she's managing you really well.
No, she actually is not. That's correct. She is actually the boss. I am not the boss. Even in title, I'm not the boss, but definitely not in practicality. So thanks for joining us on the You Project. How's your day been?
Well, I was going to say, like Melissa, the sun is shining, and when the sun is shining and you're heading into a long weekend, all is good.
What do you got planned? Are you a footy girl? Of course, for those around the world, we have a bunch of listeners around the world, but there's a thing in Australia I was going to say Melbourne, it's always in Melbourne, but it's not because of the pandemic. It's in Queensland, Northern Australia, called the AFL Grand Final, which is a big deal. You're a footy fan, an NRL fan, an anything fan?
Well, I'm a Brizzy girl by birth, and so I grew up with rugby, but union more so than league. And I found it interesting when I first moved to Melbourne, in my first couple of months, the first question, so what team do you barrack for? Mm. And so I think if you live in Melbourne and you don't follow the football, there's a whole slice of life and conversation that you just can't partake in. So I wouldn't say I'm a huge fan, but I will be watching the game with my husband, keeping him company.
Who's the team that you allegedly barrack for, but not really? Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. The one that gets you through social awkwardness.
Melbourne. And there's a whole history behind how we picked that team. And,
oh, really?
And I was going to say, it actually shows my rational side, because it was a very rational process as to how we picked Melbourne.
Well, give us a little snapshot of that.
Well, when my husband and I, before Craig and I got married, I had this whole kind of notion. I said, I think it's really weird how partners have different teams. I just don't get that. Like, surely you want to have the same team, because then when you go to the game together, it becomes a social outing. And Craig's kind of like, oh, okay. Anyway, so we basically both wrote down three teams that we liked, and we put them in a hat, and we pulled it out of a hat. And that's how we went for our team. And it turned out the only team that we both had written down was Melbourne. I had Melbourne, Richmond and Brisbane, and Craig had Melbourne, Hawthorn and the West Coast. So we would have been much better if we'd gone for Richmond. We would have had more luck.
Well, you can't say that now. Now, because you're a faithful, passionate, loyal, fully committed Melbourne supporter. Yeah.
Well, it's been 18 years. I've followed that team. 18 years. Because my view is if you pick a team, no fair weather friend, you've got to stick with them, even if they have really bad years. You've just got to stick it through.
What made you come to, I agree, what made you, well, there's one caveat. If you grow up barracking for a football club, all our US listeners are going, what's barracking? Barracking is rooting. But in Australia, rooting is not barracking.
It's something Australia, else entirely.
Just to be clear for my US friends, you rooting is fucking. So there you go, a little lesson in Australian. I know. And thongs are not thongs. And fanny packs are not fanny packs. We could have a whole lesson on that. We could go deep. What brought you to Melbourne from the north?
So I left Brisbane when I was 20. So as soon as I finished university, I worked in politics and got a job down here. And so I still remember it. I'd never lived out of home before. And my parents were working overseas at the time. And I still remember ringing mum and dad who were in Singapore going, I'm moving to Melbourne. They're like, you've never lived out of home and you don't even own a car. We didn't even know you were applying for roles interstate. And so basically I packed up and got a car and I drove myself down to Melbourne and here I am.
And here you are. 5 years later, at the ripe old age of 25, happily married to Craig.
You can add a few more digits to the years, but thanks for the compliment.
Well, we know how old Craig is because there's nobody in the world called Craig who's less than 45. So there's. Have you ever met a Craig, Michelle, who's under 30?
Ah, that's a very good point.
The answer is no, because there isn't one in the world.
Isn't that interesting? And Craig is 45.
Mm.
So
good guess by me.
But I am older.
Oh, really?
Mm.
You scarlet woman.
Exactly.
whatever that means. My mum used to say that. Melissa, can you Google that? Let me know. All right. Now, you've written a book. Firstly, before we find out about the book, give us a little bit of your journey, your work journey. What did you do? What have you done? Where have you been? What were your roles? What did you learn? And where are you at now?
Wow, what a big question, because that could take, I can talk the leg off a chair, that could take days.
It's okay, I've got a drink, I'll get comfy.
Excellent. Look, in a nutshell, as soon as I left university, I went into politics. So I was a speechwriter, did policy work. That then led to me working in the mining sector. I worked in the mining sector in public policy, public affairs roles before I moved into financial services. And as I was doing all of that, I was moving a lot. So I think, you know, in the early sort of first decade of my career, I moved probably four or five times. So I would move geographic locations for work. And then when I was in financial services, I spent time working in Sydney, working in Melbourne, working in Hong Kong, working in Singapore. So even though Melbourne for the last, you know, 20 odd years has predominantly been home, that's also included a little sort of stints here and there. And then during my time in financial services, I've had quite a varied career in terms of jumping functional disciplines. So I've done everything from heading up compliance functions to running large scale change programs to being a company spokesperson, working for the CEO. So, and often when people look at my career, they go, wow, that's really unusual. How did you manage to work across such a broad raft of different roles? And for me, it was because I always had these, what I call kind of key skills that you were taking with you. And I wasn't getting hired in some of those roles for my technical skills. I was getting hired for my ability to build good teams and be able to get stuff done.
Mm. So you're a very good communicator. That's apparent. Well done. And if you, when you're 20-ish, you're writing speeches for politicians, clearly you're a good writer, which is part of communication. So is your, and I talk about communication and the value of that and the significance and importance. Obviously, that's a no-brainer, but it's not something that we talk about enough, is improving communication and self-awareness in personal situations and all that. So is that for you something that's really developed or is it innate? Because to me it seems, well, probably a bit of both, but it seems like you're a natural connector and communicator and a natural people person.
I think it depends on the context. And by that I mean, so if I go back early in my career, and like people look at me and go, oh, you know, Michelle, you're so confident, you're so this, you're so that. I think, wow, so much of this was learned. And particularly when I moved into corporate roles, I still remember early on in, you know, junior management roles, you know, I'd sit in meetings and I'd be so nervous about speaking up. And I'd sit there thinking, oh my God, I haven't said anything. Oh my God, we're 20 minutes in, I still haven't said anything. Oh my God, we're an hour in, I still haven't said anything. And I would feel the anxiety rising. And then I realized that if I didn't crack that nut, if I didn't find a way to overcome my nerves about putting forward my opinion and my perspective, there is no way I'd be able to progress. And so I look at that and go, I could communicate, but in certain environments, I could feel intimidated. And if I felt intimidated, I would withdraw. And then I found a way to overcome that.
And that was?
It was recognizing this matters to me, and the only way, you know, I was ambitious, and for me to progress, I knew I had to find a way to, it was almost like recognize the nerves, recognize that means I'm taking this seriously and it's important to me, but that's not going to stop me. And so it's even the same when I do public speaking. You know, I do public speaking, people go, oh, wow, that was amazing. You know, you're really confident. And I think, yeah, it doesn't mean I'm not nervous. And so I always say to people, when you're doing things, I think we sometimes expect to not have nerves, but I've learned that the nerves are actually a good thing for me, because what the nerves are saying to me is, Michelle, you're taking this seriously. It matters for you. And that practice what you're saying, how you're saying it, and how you're delivering it, because then you get more comfortable. And each time you do something, it gets slightly easier.
Yeah, I think I always share a similar message. And I reckon insecurity, a bit of insecurity, a bit of self-doubt, a bit of nerves, a bit of all of that stuff, for me personally, I like it, because it keeps me grounded and it keeps me on my toes and it keeps me vigilant and it keeps me hungry and it keeps me working. Like, I think if I had no fear, no anxiety, no feeling of being a fraud, which is an ever-present thing sometimes with some things, I probably wouldn't have done all the things I've done. I probably wouldn't have achieved as much as I have. In fact, we did a thing the other night. We were talking about and this is a spoiler alert for my, oh no, they won't hear it. I was going to say my Thursday night mentoring group. On my Monday night, we're doing this Thursday now, but on my Monday night mentoring group, which is a whole bunch of people and me online for a couple of hours, we spoke about the value of mediocrity. We spoke about the value of fucking up and failing and falling down and not being genetically gifted and not being the smartest in the room and not being the most talented and all of those things. And for me, which I just described to myself, I actually think that, of course, it's great to be gifted and talented, but I don't know that that's always the asset that people think it might be over time. And then some of, because I've worked with, you know, a bunch of Olympians and a bunch of, like, I've worked with AFL clubs, a lot of elite athletes, as well as, you know, corporates and all that stuff. But my experience with elite athletes is, and tell me if you've seen this in your journey or on your journey, is that sometimes you get these people that come into the program that just get recruited or drafted or brought into whatever environment, whatever sport, whatever role, and their raw talent and ability and potential is fucking breathtaking. But then you see them doing the thing and you go, oh, I don't know if this is going to work, because they've got no resilience. They've got no work ethic. They're scared of everything. And they, you know, they have 11 out of 10 talent, but they have a 3 out of 10 level of effort most of the time. And then conversely, other people who come into the program that I think, I'm not sure. And then they just have this capacity to just work harder and bigger and better and longer. And you go, yep, okay. You know, what about you?
Well, I've often said it, and I wrote about this in my first book. I was not the smartest kid in the class, but I was the hardest working. And I put down, you know, I come from a very academically gifted family. And I look at, you know, I was the youngest in the family, and every single teacher at school, wow, oh, we had your sister last year, and your brother, they're smart. Are you as smart as them? And I wasn't. And you know, and I look at it and go, that could have done a lot of damage, because it could send you two ways. You go completely off the track where you go, well, bugger this, I'm never going to be as smart as them, so let's just give up. Whereas for me, what it did was actually drove an incredible work ethic and an incredible drive to actually prove what I was capable of. But what I also find, I used to say this to people when I was hiring in a team, I will always hire for attitude over technical skill. I can teach people the technical skill, a process, it's far harder to teach attitude. And so if you've got someone who is willing to learn and they're really keen and really interested in the work, that is far more valuable than, well, they've ticked all these three or four boxes. And so I used to often say to people, particularly when I was recruiting, often the HR recruitment people would have this sort of cheat sheet. Oh, well, you've got to do this, this, and this, and this. And I'd always say to HR, I want to see all the CVs. And they go, really? We've had hundreds. I said, I don't care. I can scan really quickly, but I'm making the selection as to who I'm interviewing. Because more often than not, they would shortlist people. And then I would look and go, actually, you've missed a whole heap of other people that I would actually put in, because they would just be looking for technical skills.
Yeah, I completely agree. And there's something huge to be said about the people component of any kind of service or product or business, you know, that of course requires connection and interaction and conversation and exchange of ideas and teamwork and synergy and, you know, creating a culture and all of those things. And you know, in my business, I owned gyms for a long time and I owned personal training facilities and I had about 500 trainers over 25 years work for me. And the funny thing was, almost never did any of my staff get asked what their qualifications were. I reckon in, you know, and I only stopped working in gym 6 years ago, and believe it or not, I'm nearly 35 now, which is incredible. But so in, I don't know, 35 years really of working in gyms, I reckon I got asked what my qualifications were twice, if that, which is not a good or bad thing. It's just a reality. But people connect with, when it comes to a gym instructor or a trainer or even a doctor, like people just, if I go and I see a doctor and she's amazing or he's amazing and they're funny and they care and they're interested and they seem compassionate and they seem kind and they seem like they actually really want to help me, I want that person again. I don't give a fuck if they went to Shitfest College or Melbourne Uni. Like, it doesn't matter to me. I'm not going, where did you get your medical degree? What are you laughing at, Melissa?
Oh, just you.
Well, do you know what I mean? Like, some people really...
I was going to say, I do think though, when it comes to surgery, as someone who had surgery 2 weeks ago, I do want to make sure that I am dealing with someone who is absolutely master of their craft, but the added extra, the ability to care and connect. So I know a couple of years ago when my husband was having shoulder surgery and we were asking, I was asking the doctor some questions and he got really shitty at me for asking questions. And I thought, well, I'm going to serve it right back to you. I said, don't forget who's paying your bill. And he kind of just looked at me and I said, we are paying the bill. This is private. And so this is elective surgery and I'm going to sit here and ask you as many questions as I want to ask you. And his tone then changed. But I thought, wow, he just didn't want, I don't know why, but he did not want people to ask questions. And I wasn't questioning to find fault. I was questioning because I was genuinely interested in terms of what's the recovery. What were we going to need to do? What was the value in actually getting the surgery done? And all of that kind of stuff. And so I kind of think, you know, it's, I think the challenge is, and you see this through a lot of the research around power, is that the more power people feel, the more they think they're right. Dasha Keltner, who works for Berkeley, does amazing research in this space. And, you know, if you think you're more powerful, you're more likely to cheat, have affairs, break road rules. And so often when you get people who are in powerful positions, they just don't like people asking them questions because they see it as an insult.
Yeah, well, that's true. They have a superiority complex. And it's, and I also think that there's a bit of ego in that, but there's also a bit of insecurity in that. And if, as you said, I mean, one, you're paying the bill, and even perhaps more importantly, you're cutting into my husband's body. So I'll ask as many questions as I want. There is the whole power thing's really interesting, isn't it? Because it's kind of a lot of it is about perception. Have you read or heard of, I'm sure you have heard of at least, The 48 Laws of Power.
I have. So, it's a very interesting book.
Yeah, Robert L. Greene. So that's an interesting book. That's the biggest selling book in the prison system in the US, that or the most read book. But it's, and it's because it's almost a book about how to corrupt and manipulate and coerce and control people, but read the right way, which for me is just as a kind of a synopsis of human behavior and like exploring a particular component of psychology. It's fascinating. It's fascinating.
It is. And the question is, do you see power as good or bad? And I don't think it's necessarily binary. And so it's really, you know, I often say to people, there's a big difference between power over and power from within. Mm. So the power from within in terms of your sense of self, your sense of self-worth, your ability to stand up for yourself and actually have a voice, that's power from within, which is really, you know, it's really important because if you don't have that, people can walk all over you. They can manipulate you and take advantage of you. The power over is the sense of domination. You know, I'm the smartest person in the room. I've got all the ideas. You're the underling. You do what I say. And I think what's really dangerous is the University of Southern California and London Business School look at the correlation between feelings of power and I think I'm right. And the more power you feel you have, the more likely you are to think that your opinion is right. So when you think about organizations, which are by their very definition power constructs, that's really dangerous because you've got this group of people at the top, often very similar demographic backgrounds, and they're all thinking, I've got power, I feel the power. They don't necessarily even notice that they've got power, and they're all sitting there thinking that they're right. And so how does that play into decision making? How does that play into the choices that you're making? And I often say, you know, understanding power, recognizing that you have power is one of the most critical things that you need to do as a leader, because often leaders don't do that. They just don't recognize that they've got power.
Is it possible to have power but not respect?
They're two totally different constructs, because you can have power. You can be high up and you can have power because you've got the ability to make decisions and people don't respect you.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And if you've got power by virtue of the position that you hold and therefore, you know, it's kind of assigned power, but the people under you think you're a dickhead, they don't like you, they resent you, and they don't really want to work for you, they just have to. That's going to be, well, unless you have no awareness of that or you're a sociopath, which is quite likely. Do you ever go into a space where you, I've had this happen a few times where I've gone to work with a company to do a day or a half day, and it, you know, they want me to talk about all the normal stuff, a bit of inspiration and motivation, but also a bit of, you know, psychology 101, a bit on communication and connection and relationships, a bit on culture. And I meet the boss and I go, oh, I found the problem before I've even met the staff. And I go, hey, everyone, it's up here in this office. I've found it. We don't need to do today. Let me just talk to this dude for a while. Do you ever realize that, well, not the totality, but a big part of the culture problem or the, you know, the environment or the workplace challenges are because of the person, he or she, who's the captain of the ship, inverted commas?
Look, I think it's interesting, because what I often see with leaders, it's a lack of self-awareness. A lack of self-awareness of the impact that they're having on people. And I stick my hand up and I say this in the book. You know, early in my leadership career, I didn't realize the impact that I was having on others. And, you know, I was doing good work. I got good feedback from people, but I could drive things really hard. I can be relentless and I have an incredible capacity to work fast and work hard. And it was my leader who I worked for, who was amazing, who pulled me aside and said to me, Michelle, look, I get the work's important and I get you're ambitious. She goes, that's all great. But she said, no one's going to remember the work. She said, when you move on to something else, someone else will come in and they'll do your work better or differently. The only thing the people around you are going to remember is how you impacted and how you made them feel. And have you helped develop them? Have you helped get them to where they need to get to in their career? She said, that's what you need to do as a leader. That's your job. And it totally, I mean, thankfully this was all quite early in my career, but it really flipped my lens. You know, it was far more now about focusing on people, less about the task. And I think, you know, what I often see with leaders is they have good intent, but they don't realize the impact that they're having on others. And so then when you do the 360 degree feedback and they see the feedback and they've got data and they can see the gap between how they think they lead and how they actually lead, then they're kind of going, oh my God, I had no idea. And so I think that's the first place to start, is to really help build that awareness, because it's really easy to judge. It's really easy to go, oh, it's your fault, it's all this. But when you actually sit down with them, actually work through, understand the context in which they're working, the environment, how that impacts them, the pressure they're getting from their boss, also whether they're getting the right support from the team, and then what that picture paints, then you're better able to go, okay, how do we shift the dial?
And so how long did you have from when you started work to now, how much of your career did you have a boss? Like what percentage? 50%, 70%? Because you work for you now, right?
I do work for me. I would say, so you're gonna make me think. I'm gonna have to do maths on a Thursday afternoon, Craig. Look, so I've been working for 30 years and I've been running the business for 6. So for 25 years I had a boss, but if I go back to the days when I worked at Maya selling men's suits in my uni days, I had a boss back then. And I worked for my parents when I was very early, like I think about grade 9, grade 10, I did some work for my parents. I think my parents wanted to sack me though, and I wanted to sack them. We didn't work together very well.
Tell me about, without mentioning names or companies or without giving anyone away, but tell me about your worst boss and why, and tell me about your best boss and why.
Worst boss, narcissist, and very hard in that sense to work for in terms of creating the connection that I need to be my best. But the really interesting thing, and I often say this to people when they're going, I hate my environment, I hate my boss, I look at myself now and go, I wouldn't be where I am now if I hadn't worked for him. And so, you know, there's always the long term. What's the long term benefit? And you learn a lot about yourself. And if I look back, I would have, if I knew what I knew now, I would have handled the situation differently. And then I'm really lucky. I've had some amazing bosses who really backed me and supported me. And, you know, they trusted you. They were the sort of people who were like, Michelle, you'll get this done. And I'm like, yeah, but I've never done it before. They said, but we know you will. You'll figure it out. Go for it. And they're the best bosses because they stretch you, but they do it in a way where you know that there's a safety net.
I think even if you have you're right, even if you have a bad boss, you learn how not to be if you want to be a boss in the future. You know, people used to say to me, people used to always want to come and do field work at my gym, and I could only take so many people. And they'd say, oh, but I want to do it. I want to go somewhere great. And, you know, I want to learn and I want to be, you know, around great people. And I'd say, look, go and do it anywhere, because even if you end up at a bad gym with bad people, you're going to know what not to do, because you're going to see the good and the bad, you know? So not that you know, because so much of, especially in, and that's a very specific environment, but so much of whether or not people are good at their job in a gym as a fitness professional, be it whatever, personal trainer, gym instructor, you know, group X teacher, is, yeah, they need skills and all of that, but they also need empathy and they need kindness and they need to care and they need to be able to communicate and they need to be able to be present. And so much of what makes someone really good in that space is not whether or not they can do a body composition test. It's not whether or not they can teach a bench press or a squat. That's part of it. But it's really about, do people like being around this guy or this girl? And do they want to come back to this place in this environment with this person? I think that's kind of broadly true across the board. And so how much of who you are today as, you know, someone who owns their own business and does their own thing, and you're a teacher of sorts because you're teaching people things, you're an educator, you're a speaker, you're an author. How much of that is through observation and experience and just miles on the clock personally? And how much of it is for you just intuitive and innate, like your knowledge and understanding about this stuff?
I think it's a balance. And I think one of, you know, I often say to people, one of the benefits that I bring is I'm not just talking theory, I'm talking practice. I've lived it. I've been in corporates. I understand organizational dynamics because I've lived the experience of it and I got to exec level. The learning is I am a constant learner. I often say to people, I should wear the t-shirt. I'm a nerd and I'm proud because I have an insatiable appetite for knowledge. And so for me, if I don't know something, I go and figure it out and I'm always reading and I'm always studying. So a bit like you, I'm back studying now as well. So for me, that next sort of level of study is just the evolution of my development. And I think when you're working in this space, you always have to keep learning. The day you've stopped learning is the day that you become obsolete because we are continuing to learn so much about how we work and how we think and how we process information. And that's what I find fascinating. And there is a big part of it that's also intuitive. You know, I often find with my coaching clients, they'll say to me, how do you understand? You've just summed up my work environment. How have you done that? You've never been there. Like you've never worked there. And I somehow have this ability, and I'm assuming it's just through experience, to sum up a work environment and to be able to go, this is what's going on and this is what's going on for the other person. And therefore, here are some ideas and some things to apply. And I would say for people who know me really well, I've had a number of people who've said this, you know, Michelle, you're now doing what you were born to do, but I don't think I could do this effectively if I hadn't been through all the experiences that I've been through. And I hadn't had that extensive corporate experience because otherwise it would feel slightly false because you're trying to give advice and ideas, but you've never actually lived it.
Well, we should probably talk about your book because that's kind of why we're here. So it's called Bad Boss, What to Do If You Work for One, Manage One, or Are One. So give us a snapshot. Now, just to give you some context, we've got about 15 minutes. So give us a snapshot, Michelle, of the four types of bosses and how to deal with them.
Yeah, I would say it's very important that you put in the full title. A friend of mine in Canada just put in Bad Boss and she sent me the image of what comes up and apparently it's all very romantic novels.
Oh, really? Wow.
kind of genre of the big bad.
A little bit like
the big bad boss.
You're such a bad boss.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. I just creeped myself out. All right. So
put the full title. So look, it's where it comes from in terms of the four different types of bosses is it's really thinking back and going, to what extent is the leader aware of the impact that they're having and where's their focus? Is it all about them or is it all about their team? So are they selfish or selfless? And that's where you then get the four different types of boss because the first one is the mercenary. With the mercenary, it's all about them. You know, make me look good. They don't care that they're having a bad impact, but they also have incredibly low levels of self-awareness. They're just not interested because their focus is all about their needs. Mm. We then have what I call the believer. This is someone who is genuinely interested in their team. They actually can be a really nice person, but they're an ineffective leader because they don't understand the impact that they're having. They just want people to like them. And because they want people to like them, they're not willing to step into conflict. They're not willing to step in and solve issues. They just want all of that. You know, be happy. I'm not interested in getting involved in the stuff that's kind of messy. Then you have what I call the illusionist. And in many respects, this is your classic narcissist. And they're also often the hardest to work with because they can charm the pants off you, but they will very happily throw you under the bus if it gets them to where they need to get to. So you can work for someone like that as long as you're meeting their needs and you've got to be very careful because there is absolutely no loyalty. Then the last category is what I call the liberator. And this is your classic good boss. And this doesn't mean that they are perfect every single day, because I think that's unrealistic. People will fluctuate and there are days where people, you know, have an off day, but they have awareness. They understand the impact that they're having on people and they genuinely try to bring out the best in themselves and also the best in people around them.
Wow. That's three out of four and not that good, Melissa. Am I the mercenary, the believer?
You're the last one.
Oh, shut up. Do you know what?
Checks in the mail.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Your second warning's been removed. But you're exactly, well, of course you're right. You've studied this. You're an author in it. You're a bloody expert in it. So I don't need to tell you you're right. But it's interesting, Michelle, because that that need to be liked, number two, the believer, that that people pleaser, that insecurity, please like me, I know I'm in a position of authority over you, but nah, we're really just friends though. And it's there's a real balancing act and skill to being able to, and I've had to do it, there's a difference between being someone's friend and being friendly. And I've had to over the years, I started out as a believer, where I just wanted all my staff to love me, all my clients to love me, never have to deal with anything messy because I'll just create the best environment and the best culture, just be like a big happy fucking family. We'll sing Kumbaya and we'll hang out at Christmas and we'll give each other gifts and I'll give everybody bonuses and they'll love me. And yeah, that lasted about a year or two and you go, oh. Because one of my stories, my quick stories is, and this is a long time ago, but when I first had a team, I had about, at this stage, I had about, first year that I did this, I had about 12 staff and I gave them all a bonus. And as I'm thinking out loud, this is probably not legal, but it was a long time ago. It may have been a cash bonus, may not have been, could have been produce, who knows? Anyway, so I gave about, I think it was about 10 of my staff, a really decent, let's just call it a really decent Christmas present. And they're all ecstatic. And then the next year came around and that year wasn't quite as lucrative or profitable as the year before. It was still good, but I gave them all another really good Christmas present, but it was essentially the same as the year before. But when I gave them that Christmas present, I could see the disappointment on their face because they'd expected some kind of linear progression in the value of their Christmas present. And I just went, oh, what have I done? I've created a fucking monster because I gave them X last year and now they want X plus 0.5, you know? And I'm like, oh, and it was, so I had to stop that. I stopped giving bonuses and I stopped giving, in inverted commas, gifts because I'd basically created a problem for myself by trying to keep everyone super happy. And I just realized you can't. Like, you still need to be kind and thoughtful and empathetic, but you also need to lead. And part of leadership is just sometimes hard conversations and hard choices.
Look, and it's interesting. Someone asked me the other day, they said, can you be a leader and be friends with the people that you work with? And I said, it really depends on the people that you're working with. You know, yeah. I had a person that I worked with and over time, her and I became very good friends, but she always respected the boundary. And she would never overstep that boundary. And I wouldn't overstep the boundary as well. In terms of when we were in the workplace, we knew that there were times that I would say no. There were times that I would make decisions that she wouldn't like. It was about making sure that she wasn't treated as a favorite, all of that kind of stuff. And I think the hardest thing with so much of this is, you know, fairness is a really important element and it's a big trigger for people. If people aren't treated fairly, it has a huge impact on motivation. And, you know, we know with equity theory that if people don't think things are equitable, they will take matters into their own hand. But the challenge with fairness is a perception. I can think that I'm being incredibly transparent and incredibly fair and that everyone else around goes, oh, that doesn't look fair. You know, where did she come up with that from? And so I think that's the hard thing as a leader is, how much can you be clear and transparent about what you're doing and why you're doing it? And also making sure that everything you do is clean. Because I think that by cleanness, I mean that you're above reproach because your integrity above all else really matters. If you lose your integrity, it's very hard to regain that.
Hey, we're chatting with Michelle Gibbings, who's written Bad Boss. And don't forget the second bit, what to do if you work for one, manage one or are one. In all good bookstores. And is it an audio book as well, Michelle?
No, look, it's not yet an audio book. And the reason for that, it's got lots of reflection activities in it. So it is one of those books. It's a bit like all of my books. They're all designed to really get people to think and there's activities in it. And the challenge with the audio book is to actually then download an activity workbook that goes with it, makes it a little bit harder. So no, you need to go, you can do Kindle. But I would also encourage you, look, it's interesting. I'm a reader and I am very deliberate about which books I do in hard copy and which books I do in Kindle. And I think there are certain books where there's real value in being able to highlight, being able to write. We know through the research that there is something in terms of how our hand moves and a translation to learning in the brain. And yes, people can learn by audio listening, but I think you learn differently when you actually write notes and you really deeply think about what it is you're reading about.
Mm. So I'm going to ask you a weird question. So with what I do, there are some reoccurring themes because I'm always talking to people about how to self-manage, how they can manage themselves. So mind, emotions, body, energy, opportunities, resources, situation, time, relationships, blah, 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 blah. But there's a couple of things that I always find myself coming back to. I want to know if you have a version of this. There's more than what I'm about to share, but actually I'm just going to share one. So the thing that I've talked to repeatedly, almost daily to people about for 35 years is this idea of like the dichotomy of we want to learn and grow and change and improve and adapt and become better, but at the same time we want to stay comfortable, and that's the problem. And discomfort mostly is where we learn and grow and adapt and develop skill and resilience. And so I'm always talking about the value of, in an intelligent way, not a reckless way, but the value of getting uncomfortable. What's the one thing that you go, fuck, I'm back here again, I'm talking about, where, but it's just something that's an ever-present part of your conversation with people that's never going to go away, and it's people, you know, people get it, but there's always a group of people that don't get it, and you need to go, all right, let's go back to basics, you know, because sometimes back to basics is, okay, you've got a plan, you've got a strategy, you've got goals, you've got a timeline, you've got all these things, that's amazing. You've got clarity of purpose and vision. Cool. Are you going to do the work though? Like sometimes it's that fundamental. What's the go-to for you where you're always coming back to a core message?
Well, there's a big thing for me in terms of learning, and I similar to you in terms of that uncomfortable piece. I always say if you're not feeling uncomfortable, you've stopped learning. Because when you're uncomfortable, that is just your brain creating a new neural pathway, is just telling you that you're learning something that you've never done before. The piece that I often say to people, it's so easy for us to point to the other person when relationships aren't working and want that other person to change. You can't change other people. You can influence them, but you cannot change them. And so the most important thing in terms of looking at a workplace and when things aren't working is to start with you and to go, what needs to change in you for you to be able to thrive in this environment? Because often what we do is we step away from conversations that are hard. We expect the other person to change and the other person to go first. And actually you need to go first.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I'm always talking or asking people, is it your situation or whatever circumstance environment that needs to change, or is it you that needs to change in the middle of that? Just quickly back to the four categories of bosses, the mercenary, the believer, the illusionist, the liberator. Which one of the mercenary, believer and illusionist is most trainable to become a liberator?
The believer.
If the believer, okay.
Because they already have a desire to be a good leader. What they're missing is the awareness.
Yeah, right.
And so if you can give them awareness, and because that's the thing, often people can be thinking they're doing a really good job, and then when you show them the data, they go, oh my God, I had no idea that this is how people were seeing me. And also because they're going, but I'm being professional. I'm going, yeah, you're being professional, but people see you as detached. People see you as hard to get to know, hard to build a relationship with. And so there's a real balance for people when they go, okay, so how do I still maintain my sense of authentic self? And that's the people say, you know your values, because it's not about changing your values, but this is about really understanding how do I make sure I'm bringing my best? And yes, that means there may be behaviors that you are exhibiting that you need to change. And that's a long process. It doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah, it's really interesting. What you're mentioning there is actually the focus of my PhD, which is understanding how we're seen by others. And it's a really important construct in not just psychology, but in just communication and relationships is, you know, because we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. And one of the questions that I ask bosses often is, what do you think it's like being around you? And they squirm. I go, what do you think that you experience is for the people who work with you and for you? And most of them have not really thought deeply about that. And I go, you need to think about that. not from a point of view of insecurity or fear or anxiety or self-doubt, but rather just self-awareness. Because if you think you are giving, like in your mind, you're giving them feedback and encouragement and support, but what they are getting, in inverted commas, is criticism and judgment and attitude, it doesn't matter what your intention is, because they don't live in your intentions. They create their own reality through their own data processing center, just like you do. You know, and that, it's that, you know, this opens the door on the whole, you know, subjective nature of being human and understanding that I'm in a room with 10 other people who are all having 10 different experiences right now, despite the macro of where we're all at, same place, same time, same conversation, same room, no one's having the same experience. So in terms of the work that you do, when you go in, do you go in and do a presentation and go, ta-da, this is what we do, or this is what we know, and you kind of give a little bit of a snapshot of the four types of bosses and what people can do to improve or learn or evolve? Or do you have a program or a process?
Look, it really depends on what the organization needs. I'm very much based on bespoke work. I always say to people, I don't do cookie cutter. This is not, here's a program and ta-da, I'm going to roll it all out in exactly the same way. I'm much more experiential. I really want to understand the culture, the context of the organization, then work out what they need. And also this is my third book. So my first book was all about influence. My second book was all around careers and actually how do you have, you know, a really dynamic sort of career in a world that's changing. This one is much more focused on leadership. They all connect to each other in terms of the learnings that you've got from that as well. And I also do a lot of work around decision making. And so with the work that I'm doing in corporates, it's very much understanding where's the pain point, what's the shift that needs to be made. Is that a shift that's individual or is it a shift that's collective? So is this one-on-one work or is this actually team-based work? And I find, you know, it's interesting. I think that's why I love what I do, because every environment is so different. Yes, there's commonality and you often see really, you know, common threads the whole way through in terms of the issues that people are having. But there's also uniqueness in that because everyone's culture, and as you were saying before, everyone's experience of what's going on is different. You know, the stories that we write in our head and the interpretation that we're putting on events and how do you actually help people understand the meaning that they're putting on what's going on and recognizing that that meaning isn't necessarily fact.
So interesting. All right. So give us a couple of, as we wind up, two or three kind of take-home messages that you want to share. So we have a lot of our listeners own their own businesses. A lot of our listeners are bosses or managers or leaders or coaches, which I think the same principles apply. And of course, a lot of people have bosses. So what are maybe one or two key things that you would like to leave people with before we plug your stuff?
One, you know, and this just isn't rocket science, but at the end of the day, leadership is the learned skill. And so it requires constant effort. You can't just go, you know, I've done these 10 things and now my leadership is done. It is a constant evolution because leadership is personal and leadership is contextual. The type of leader you need to be at the moment because of COVID, there will be things that you're drawing on that perhaps you haven't drawn on before. So all of that becomes really important. But underneath all of this, who are you? What do you stand for? And what really matters? Because when the chips are down and when the shit's hitting the fan, that is the stuff that grounds you. That is the stuff that really helps you navigate your way through. And then thirdly, who have you got around you that will hold the mirror up to you, that will really help challenge you in terms of how you see the world? You don't own the license on being right. And it's really important to have people around you who help you see the world in a way that is different. And part of that is actually then also taking care of yourself. You cannot be an effective leader if you don't eat well, if you don't sleep well, if you don't exercise. All of the things that we naturally know that we need to do, they are critical. Because if you turn up to work tired, hungry, it just feeds into a negative emotions. And then you're not in an effective place to deal with tough situations and make good decisions.
I love it. And also, just one last question. What about the ability to be okay with being wrong? Do you think that's important?
It's crucial. I always say to people, the day you think you're the smartest person in the room is the day that you need to change rooms because you've stopped learning. It is so, and I think this is the real danger in organizations where we create this environment where we go, well, the leaders have to have all the answers. They can't have all the answers. And if you've ever read any of Andrew Hopkins' work, so Andrew Hopkins is an academic from ANU, and he's the one that gets called in to all of the big disasters, you know, BP Texas City Oil Refinery, Piper Alpha. He does, you know, all of those Esso Longford gas explosion. He does the post-mortem. What happened? What went wrong? And at the crux of his findings, typically it's culture, but also how decisions are made. And what he talks about is the importance of how leaders get involved in making decisions and the criticality of people accepting the roles that they need to play in decision-making. And part of that with leaders is really recognizing you cannot have all the information in your head. The world's too complex. It's changing too quickly. You have to be open to going, I don't know. And let's figure this out. Now, there's a big difference between that and, oh my God, I've got no idea. Because people want certainty. People like leaders who show calmness when things are not going well. So there's a big difference in terms of how you deliver the message. But there's nothing wrong with a leader going, I actually don't know that, but we're going to figure it out. And we're going to figure that out together.
I love it. Hey, Melissa, before we just wrap up and talk about Michelle's book, I got a present from one of our listeners.
Did Jess you?
Jess Berkeley.
Yes.
And are you ready? This is what, just say, and now on with the show.
We love Jess.
Did you hear, what did that sound like? Did that sound like clapping or
rain on
the roof?
Yeah, it sounded like, well, a bit of both, but I'm guessing it's meant to be clapping.
What about this one?
Oh, God.
No, that's gross.
Oh dear, drum roll. Oh kids, oh, I'm such an idiot. Michelle Gibbings is the author, she's the speaker, she's the woman you need to get in to talk to your team and work with your organization. Bad Boss, What to Do If You Work for One, Manage One, or Are One. Now, where do people get it? Do you have a website? Are you on socials? What's the go?
So you can get it through all good bookstores, you know, Amazon, Booktopia, Dimex. If you go to www.thebadboss.com.au, you can, if you buy the book, send some details. You actually get a whole heap of extra free stuff as well. So you can do that. And you can also go to my just website, michellegibbings.com. And yes, you know, socials, I'm there. Facebook, Insta, LinkedIn, Twitter. You name it.
All the normal stuff.
Yes, Michelle. And go to Instagram and you'll see photographs of my dog. He gets more likes than I do.
You sound like Joe Rogan. His dog gets the same. Stay there, Michelle. We'll come to you after we jump off air. Melissa, anything else? Bossy pants?
Nothing from me. Thank you so much, Michelle. That was great.
My pleasure.
All right, everybody. Love you guts. Thank you for being part of another episode of The You Project. See you next time.